Welcome to STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
Welcome to STEM Talk, where we introduce you to fascinating people who passionately inhabit the scientific and technical frontiers of our society. Hi, I'm your host, Dawn Cornegas, and joining me to introduce today's podcast is the man behind the curtain, Dr. Ken Ford, IHMC's director and chairman of the Double Secret Selection Committee that selects all the guests who appear in STEM Talk.
Hi, Dawn. Great to be here.
So nearly 5 million people in the U.S. today have Alzheimer's disease. In 30 years, the Alzheimer's Association predicts that number is going to swell to 16 million people. So today's podcast is Dr. Stephen Cunane, who is a Canadian physiologist whose extensive research into Alzheimer's disease is showing how ketones can be used as part of a prevention approach that helps delay or slow down the onset of Alzheimer's.
But before we get on to today's interview, we have some housekeeping to take care of. We really appreciate all of you who have subscribed to STEM Talk, and we are particularly appreciative of all the wonderful five-star reviews positively piling up on iTunes. As we announced in earlier episodes, the Double Secret Selection Committee has been continuously and carefully reviewing the iTunes reviews with an eye towards selecting the wittiest and most lavishly praise-filled reviews to read on STEM Talk. If you hear your review read on STEM Talk, just contact us at stemtalk@ihmc.us to claim your official STEM Talk t-shirt.
Today, our winning review was posted by someone who goes by the nickname CJ Lizard, titled Always Interesting. It reads, I love this podcast. While not every guest is someone I might think to listen to, I end up almost always enjoying the interview and learning something. The hosts obviously take a lot of care in finding guests. Highly recommended.
Thank you, CJ Lizard. And thank you to all the other STEM Talk listeners who have helped STEM Talk become such a great success. And now, on to today's interview with Dr. Stephen Cunane.
Dr. Stephen Cunane is a metabolic physiologist at the University of Sherbrooke in Quebec. He is the author of 5 books, including Survival of the Fattest, The Key to Human Brain Evolution, which is published in 2005, and Human Brain Evolution, Influence of Fresh and Coastal Food Resources, which was published in 2010.
Dr. Cunane earned his PhD in physiology at McGill University in 1980. And went on to do postdoctoral research on nutrition and brain development in Aberdeen, Scotland, London, and Nova Scotia. From 1986 to 2003, he was a faculty member in the Department of Nutritional Sciences at the University of Toronto, where his research focused on the role of omega-3 fatty acids in brain development and human health. He also did research on the relation between ketones and brain development.
In 2003, Dr. Cunane was awarded a Senior Canada Research Chair at the Research Center on Aging and became a full professor at the University of Sherbrooke. He has published more than 280 peer-reviewed research papers and was elected to the French National Academy of Medicine in 2009.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
Hi, welcome to STEM Talk. I'm your host, Dawn Cornegas, and I'd like to welcome today Dr. Stephen Cunane. Stephen, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
And joining me today is also Ken Ford. Ken, welcome.
Hi, Dawn. Good to be here.
So, Stephen, you were born in London, but your family immigrated to Canada when you were still an infant, and then you grew up in a suburb just north of Montreal. I understand that as a youth, you were kind of trouble from the get-go.
Well, yeah. I mean, all the family was sort of back in the old country. We were on our own with fields around us and French Canadians around us, and we spoke English. My father was Irish. My mother was English. They never really learned to speak French. So, you know, adventure awaits, and sometimes that includes trouble, right?
That's for sure. I am told by a relatively good source that as soon as you got into high school, you spent a lot of time in the chemistry lab, and that's a good thing. But rather than doing your classwork, you sometimes focused on making explosives and laughing gas and other mischief. This can't be true, is it?
Well, actually, I was a good student in high school, and I think my top marks were in chemistry, so I didn't completely screw up on that side. But yeah, I mean, when you have those sort of ingredients, compounds waiting for you in the prep lab, and you're responsible for setting up the responsible chemistry for the other students, again, adventure awaits, and you try stuff, right? So
that seems like normal youthful exuberance.
Yeah, and I was curious. I think the bottom line is that that's what I liked about science, and it showed up perhaps in the chemistry lab, but I liked exploring stuff and why things work the way they work and so on.
So when you first started college, is it true that you nearly flunked out?
Yeah. Yep. I was away from home and I never expected to be homesick. I had a girlfriend who was back at home, which was about 100 miles away. And, you know, you get distracted. You're in a new environment and it's very easy to lose track of why you're there.
So you went on to get your PhD in physiology at McGill University. And it was when you started your PhD that your interest in science really caught on. So what happened?
Well, I was trying to get into medicine and it didn't work. And I was taking an anatomy course and a physiology course as well in order to get my grades up. And there was a prof that was teaching that, a guy from England, actually, David Horobin. I just was fascinated by his approach, his pedagogical skills. He was a very convincing, charming speaker. And I thought, wow, that would be somebody I would be cool to work with. If I don't get into medicine, what am I going to do? So I simply went up to him and asked him if he was taking any graduate students. And I really didn't even know what the focus of his research was.
So as a student, I hear that you had the opportunity to communicate with Desmond Morris and other notable thinkers. So how did that happen?
Well, as an undergrad, one of the courses we were taking involved reading a book by Elaine Morgan called Descent of Woman, as opposed to Ascent of Man, Human Evolution. And I was intrigued about the response of the paleoanthropology community to that. That was what my term paper for that course was about. How did that book go down? How did that idea go down? And Desmond Morris had commented on the whole idea of aquatic origins of humans in a way that I thought was condescending. So I got on his case. You know, and naively simply wrote to him and said, you know, you pretty well dissed that book and that concept. That's how it got started. And I never communicated with him afterwards, but I was on my high horse at the time. And, you know.
Yeah, high horses often come with fresh PhDs.
Yeah. And in fact, the reason this all got started is because David Horobin was editor of Medical Hypotheses, which still exists. He encouraged me to clean up that paper. So that's how I ended up taking a more serious interest in the topic. And David was the sort of guy who said, if I can't get my papers published in somebody else's journal, I'll start a new journal. And he started a publication house called Eden Press as well. So this is totally a maverick in science, biomedical science.
Desmond Morris is now 90 years old. I find him to be a particularly interesting fellow. I was intrigued when it first came out by his 1969 book, The Human Zoo, in which he analyzes human behavior in modern societies and notes the resemblance to animal behavior in captivity. But I'd like to point out that at least the animals that one finds in the city zoo can see the bars on their cages. As one walks through an airport or a Walmart or nearly any city street, it seems pretty evident that life in the zoo can cause some unfortunate outcomes.
That's a unique way of looking at things when we walk out the door of IHMC today.
Right. See, you can just look around.
Yeah, just take it all in. So after getting your PhD, you then traveled to Aberdeen, London, and Nova Scotia to do your postdoctoral research on nutrition and also brain development. So what was that like? And also what prompted your interest in nutrition and the brain?
With David Horobin, as I mentioned, he was an entrepreneur. He was a broad thinker, an Oxford graduate. So my PhD topic was basically unsupervised and very eclectic. And part of the work that I was doing involved studies on the physiology of zinc, how zinc interacted with eicosanoids, actually. And I found it way too complicated. So I said, let's back off and start looking at what zinc does and zinc deficiency in the body. But I had no nutrition training. So I went to Aberdeen to the Rowett Institute, which is one of the best nutrition centers in Europe. And it meant getting out of Canada, you know, going exploring. A postdoc is a personal trip as well as a scientific trip, right? So going to Scotland, I didn't know I had family roots in Scotland, but part of my mother's family is from Scotland. So that was an interesting adventure on that level as well.
Oh, fantastic. And then in 1986, you became a faculty member in the Department of Nutritional Sciences at the University of Toronto. So how did you end up teaching nutrition when you didn't have a degree in nutrition? How did that come about?
Well, you better ask the guy that hired me, the department head at the time. I thank him for his unorthodox view. I had publications, I guess. That was the main thing. I convinced people during my interview that I knew something about nutrition. And it wasn't a dietetics program. So people weren't getting a professional diploma in dietetics, in which case you have to follow a pretty strict recipe mm-hmm. when you're hiring and teaching. So it was nice because it was the only nutrition department in Canada that was in a faculty of medicine as well. So you're exposed to the implications of nutrition for health. Often dietetics and nutrition are taught outside a medical context. So it was a very nice environment to be working in. And I was teaching controversies in nutrition, actually, because nutritionists think they've got the solution to a lot of our health problems. But in many cases, they actually make some of them worse. Some of our nutrition dogma is completely incorrect. So it amounts to controversies. And it should be taught that there are controversial. There's more than one way to correct cholesterol levels, for instance, in the blood. So that was neat because it was a fourth-year program. And I wasn't trying to teach them the facts of nutrition. I was trying to teach them the issues, mm-hmm. the gray zone around nutrition. It's not all black and white.
And how to think about that, which is
fantastic. Yeah, critical thinking. You're in fourth year. You're about to graduate. Don't you realize that there's actually some controversies around calcium and osteoporosis, around cholesterol lowering, around dietary fiber and omega-3 fatty acids for that matter.
Yeah, fantastic. And then in 2003, you were awarded a Senior Canada Research Chair at the Research Center of Aging and became a full professor at the University of Sherbrooke. So how did that happen?
Well, my personal life brought me back to Quebec and I was commuting to see my girlfriend for over 3 years. It's about 500 or 600 miles. So I was obviously looking for, we were looking together for an opportunity that would bring me back into that area. I thought I was going to end up in Montreal, which was the main city nearby, but that didn't happen. And then I heard through a colleague that Sherbrooke was offering a position with this Canada Research Chair, which is quite a prestigious position in Canada. So I went to learn more about it and I didn't know anything about aging, but the aspects of nutrition that I was interested in relation to brain development, I figured wasn't a big leap of faith to apply them to the aging brain, the issues that the aging brain faces. And Sherbrooke has the best biomedical imaging center in Canada, which I've learned at the time. I could see that they could do the PET imaging and I wanted to do ketone PET. I was already quite interested in ketones at that stage. So I thought, you know, I've nothing to lose by getting out of Toronto. Toronto is sort of the navel of Canada. And at a certain point, I was looking for something else after 18 years. Mm-hmm. And it worked out fine. I'd grown up in that area. My undergrad was near Sherbrooke. So it all started to seem familiar. And I felt like it was home for the first time in nearly 30 years, even though I'd never expected to go back to Quebec.
No, that's great. Your interest in human evolution eventually led you to research the nutritional importance of shore-based food and omega-3 fatty acids in particular with respect to brain development. Can you talk about the work you did that led to your development of the hypotheses that humans evolved near the water?
Yeah, so, I mean, this came from my undergrad experience, as I mentioned, about from the book Elaine Morgan wrote called The Descent of Woman, and her book was based on the idea that food gathering that women were doing was important for human evolution. It's sort of a neglected part of human evolution. And the paper that stimulated her interest was published by Alistair Hardy called Was Man More Aquatic in the Past? Which is the thing I wrote about in my medical hypotheses article. So I had this sort of percolating in the back of my mind. You know, it's kind of like a hobby, basically. It's an interest, but it's not what you're paid to do when you're in the nutrition department, for instance. But when I started my second postdoc with Michael Crawford in London, he worked on omega-3 fatty acids. He already had a well-established reputation and brain development and omega-3 fatty acids. Marine mammals have a lot of omega-3 intake, and he's always equating the human situation to the marine mammal situation. And I said, have you heard of the aquatic ape theory, by the way? Elaine Morgan, Alistair Hardy said no. So we started discussing it, and his expertise in omega-3 fatty acid helped me understand that there was more to this than a sort of an ecological story that suggested that we have some physiological features that resemble those of marine mammals, including fatness and essentially hairless skin mm-hmm. and so on, which is sort of atypical for terrestrial primates. So we worked on that and so on. And the thing that took it forward to the next level for me was that once you learn something about infant nutrition and infant brain development, the two key points for evolution are that if the brain of the infant is not developing under optimal conditions, then the potential of the brain is not going to be achieved in the adult. So it's all very well to talk about what adults did prehistorically in ancient times, in paleo times, with the stone tools and so on, and killing animals, hunting. But the issue really is what happens to the infant's brain, because you can't exploit the potential of the adult brain if the infant brain is not developing optimally. And so with Michael, I learned that One of the major nutritional issues today is iodine deficiency. We thought we'd solved that 100 years ago with table salt, but it's still the major nutritional deficiency. It has far greater impact on brain development than omega-3 fatty acid deficiency does. And I thought, wow, this is not just an omega-3 story. Mm-hmm. And if you learn something about iodine, it's not long before you realize that iron deficiency is still a major nutritional deficiency in the world. So it's multidimensional, because I was really concerned that this was a monodimensional story. DHA created the human brain. And I thought, you know, that it's part of it, but it's got to be more than that.
Yeah.
It's absolutely got to be more. Otherwise, people that don't eat fish, you know, would be totally cognitively underdeveloped and so on. It's simply not the case.
Mm-hmm.
And the infant brain is much, much, much bigger than the adult brain proportionally at birth. Mm-hmm. And it consumes a huge amount of energy. And I thought at some point, you know, how do you get this extra energy into the brain? How do you put 75% of the infant's energy requirements into an organ that doesn't even help it survive mm-hmm. for 2, 3, 4, 5 years, right? Energy's got to be part of this. How is it so different from the primate? And you know, the most obvious difference is that we have fat babies and they don't. And mm-hmm. most people would sort of laugh at a connection. But I was learning about ketones at this point, and I realized they were important and that the fat was a source of ketones. It's also a store of DHA, by the way, so that if the mother's not consuming fish, then she's got less DHA in her milk, but she's provided some DHA during gestation to the infant, which is going to be stored in the tissues, but it's especially going to be in the fat and is going to be released over time. It's kind of an insurance policy.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, all right, so now we have a story that's more than one nutrient. It's a cluster of important nutrients. And we have a story that involves meeting the huge energy requirements of the brain, because ketones are, in fact, essential for infant brain energy metabolism. They're not simply the backup fuel for the starving adult.
Mm.
And I couldn't resist eventually trying to put this into a manuscript form and then eventually a book form. So, you know, one thing leads to another, but I was looking for that critical mass and diversity of complementary information that made a coherent story. It's not just DHA. It's not just iodine. It's not just brain structure and synapses. It's the energy that it requires to make all that system work.
So talking about these different components that are necessary, let's take a step over and talk about omega-3s for just a second. We're often told that not every source of omega-3 is equal. So what are the different forms and sources of omega-3 fatty acids, and which ones are optimal for overall wellness and brain health?
Well, it's a big question. They're not equal, that's for sure. And the simplest evidence is that if you take flaxseed oil, which is rich in alpha-linolenic acid, you can take as much as you like. We've published it, and quite a number of people have published it. You're not going to raise DHA levels in the blood.
Mm-hmm.
So if your objective is to provide DHA to the brain, it's going to be very hard to do that through alpha-linolenic acid. Now, the flip side to that is that perhaps in a vegetarian or in a vegan who hasn't been consuming any DHA throughout their entire life, the capacity to produce more DHA endogenously, because all the enzyme machinery is there, probably ramps up a little bit, although the data are not that convincing. But that still doesn't provide DHA to the developing brain. So the comparison that I think is critical is in the infant. And infants that are not given preformed DHA, all breast milk from women universally, globally, even if they've never consumed fish, has some DHA. There's much less in people that are strict vegans.
Mm-hmm.
There's much more if they are fish consumers. But breast milk contains DHA. And even those with the minimum amount of DHA are providing enough to their infant for the brain requirements of the developing infant. But if you put the infant on a formula that contains no DHA, two studies have shown that the brain content of DHA, so these babies have died in infancy, is about 50% lower than it would be on a breastfed infant.
Wow.
50% is a big number. And maybe those infants would have grown up to be normal. But you have to look at this a little bit teleologically and say, what would you prefer? To have the levels that you would see in a breastfed infant, which I think is a very reasonable reference?
Mm-hmm.
Or are you going to take the chance that you can get away with 50% less? I mean, I'm sure no woman, no parent is going to want to be confronted by that sort of decision.
Mm-hmm.
Now, women don't choose to not breastfeed knowing that there's less DHA. That's a sort of a scientific observation. It's hardly in the public domain. But the point is that the scientists that have argued about this have tended to say, oh, well, some people have said, well, we can make enough DHA. There's no issue there. But in fact, I think there is. And the brain of the infant is where you got to be really careful about cutting corners.
Mm. Yeah, for sure. So, Stephen, you were writing papers about the role of fat and ketones in brain development at the same time that the U.S. and Canada were caught up in the low-fat craze. So did you receive a lot of pushback for pushing the importance of fat and ketones?
For sure. And I fell back on the point that the ketogenic diet is with us today because it's been with us for the treatment of intractable epilepsy for nearly 100 years. In a couple of years, it's going to be 100 years since that treatment was started. And without that, the wave of interest in ketones today, it wouldn't be here. So we got a lot of pushback, for sure. We were told it was crazy, it was too dangerous, and all that sort of stuff. In fact, when I moved to Sherbrooke to start our work in aging, I wanted to explore the use of ketones therapeutically in older people to try and slow down Alzheimer's disease. And I said, there's politically and probably ethically with the IRB, the Institutional Review Board, there's no way they're going to let me do a ketogenic diet. So I'm going to have to take a different approach and use a ketogenic supplement, which is fine. But there are two studies going on now, and there's a number of publications with the ketogenic diet in older people, and cholesterol doesn't go up, and other cardiovascular risk markers don't go up. So we've built a dogma around fat over the past 50 or 60 years that I think has done a disservice because it's led to sort of a fat panic, and therefore people, you're either consuming refined carbohydrates or you're consuming refined fats, you know, which evil would you prefer? And in fact, I think we've got a problem with obesity primarily because of energy intake. We can't say that it's purely refined sugar that's the problem, and we can't really blame fat. It's the total energy intake in relation to the energy expenditure. That's the issue. It's a behavioral issue. It's sedentarity. It's people not doing enough exercise. But it's been easy to blame fat and to focus on fat and to focus on cholesterol for heart disease. And I think it's done us a disservice.
So jumping just a little bit, there's growing evidence that intermittent fasting improves cognition. Do you think there's an evolutionary basis to this effect?
I think ketones and human evolution, I think it's about the infant brain. The fact that it allowed some people to survive because food was presumably not abundantly available as it is today. There was no grocery stores, right? So some people would have starved. And some people would have survived because the brain could use ketones. There's been control studies in humans that are published in very reputable journals showing that you can starve people voluntarily under medical supervision for 60 days, which I wouldn't recommend, but it's possible. And people survived. There was absolutely no cognitive issues with those individuals, and they didn't die. So that's a long period of starvation, and it's because of ketones that those individuals can survive under those experimental conditions. So I'm sure that happens in the wild as well. The question really is that what drove evolution and ketones? And the answer is no. Natural selection cannot require some feature like surviving starvation. If you're unlucky enough to face starvation, you may die, but that's not going to change evolution. But for infant development, that it became an option to have more ketone production, which helped favor brain growth, I think was at the root of it. And the secondary benefit is that fasting could be survived longer, and including starvation.
So was it your research into the metabolism of omega-3 fatty acids and the importance of ketones that led you to write Survival of the Fattest?
Well, it's a combination. I didn't think there was anything new to write about in the omega-3 side, DHA and brain evolution. Michael Crawford has been a staunch proponent for many years. There was nothing I could say that he hadn't already said, or the what we call the cluster of brain selective nutrients, the iodine, the iron, the other minerals. There was a case to be made there, but the thing that got me onto Survival of the Fattest as a concept, as a book, was to combine that with the issue associated with brain energy requirements in infant development. I was always a little reluctant to use the title because it was obviously a nice play on Survival of the Fittest, but I also wanted people to take it seriously, and I didn't think anyone would if I used that title. I ended up taking it anyway. But
yeah, I like that book. I highly recommend it. It's really excellent.
It's a real challenge. I'd never written a book myself before, and you've got to figure out what audience you're writing for, and that was pretty difficult because you want to be able to explain stuff, but you try to use analogies sometimes, and it reads a bit hokey. I was reading it again on the plane coming down last night. I hadn't really read it much in the past couple of years, and I thought, yeah, some of my analogies are pretty folksy, but there you go.
Yeah. It's a nice piece of work.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks.
So as you've kind of been talking about, it seems that ketones and infant brain development are at the core of your way of thinking about therapeutic uses of ketones and brain evolution. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, that is the issue, I think. Ketones are important for brain development. A source of ketones is present in breast milk in the form of medium-chain fatty acids. So evolution has thought about this for all mammals. Medium-chain fatty acids and ketones are available to all mammals. Evolution has thought about this for a long time, and it seemed to me to be important. There was also the issue of the ketogenic diet being therapeutically important for intractable epilepsy. And the remarkable thing in some cases is that you totally cure the condition. In some cases, you improve it. some cases you don't make much progress, and I'm sure there's got a lot to do with the treatments that some of those children have to go through before they finally get to the ketogenic diet.
Mm-hmm.
But the bottom line is that I think you actually change the way the brain is wired in the lucky cases that do in fact overcome the epilepsy. So I saw the therapeutic potential and I thought, you know, there's a story here that needs to be told. The epilepsy part is not in the book on survival because it's about evolution, but it suggests that ketones are doing something for human brain wiring at the beginning of life that is part of us.
Absolutely. So, Stephen, what do you think it's going to take to transition to the therapeutic use of ketones?
The more traditional model of brain development simply doesn't refer to ketones. Ketones are the orphan of neonatal nutrition and biology. They're sort of the black sheep. Most people get by. They're quite happy to explain brain development without ketones. Notwithstanding the fact that people like Hans Krebs, Sir Hans Krebs, Nobel laureate in the 60s, founder of obviously the Krebs cycle, a very serious biochemist, was working on this in Oxford. I guess your question really is, how do new ideas or new approaches, new theories, theory is a bit of a grand word, but new concepts take hold? And I guess you need enough people that are familiar and comfortable with the concept. And the fact is that ketones have always had a bad rap because they're associated with type 1 diabetes and metabolic ketoacidosis. And so medical students who become doctors are never very comfortable with the idea that ketones are anything but an indicator of a serious, dangerous metabolic condition. So I guess it's going to take a wave of interest at undergraduate level and so on. And maybe we're there now, because ketones are not just the orphan of therapeutics. There's some good evidence now that they may be beneficial in Alzheimer's disease. There's interest in physical performance, sports performance, athletes. There's products out there to be tested, and some of those products are going to fall on their face, and some of those companies are going to go bankrupt, and some are going to be successful. And I think it's creating an awareness, a ground roots awareness. And that's often, you've got to do an end run sometimes around the academic establishment, and the public gets involved, and the public got involved with the ketogenic diet for epilepsy. If it weren't for the parents and the caregivers and a few doctors here and there, like John Freeman in Baltimore, it would have been in the long, long forgotten. So it wasn't because of the medical establishment or the academic establishment that we're currently recognizing the ketogenic diet for its merits today.
No, of course not. As you have noted, ketosis is an important part of postnatal life for a number of reasons, including brain development and surviving inconsistent early breast milk availability. Ketosis in infants is also supported by the presence of medium-chain triglycerides in the breast milk, and these MCTs appear to be synthesized by the breast epithelial tissue from blood glucose. MCTs are also enriched in rodent breast milk, and studies of maternal ketogenic diets during lactation are often associated with dramatically reduced ketone levels and worse neurodevelopment outcomes in the rodent offspring. One theory is that this is due to lower glucose availability to synthesize MCTs. As such, do you have any thoughts on the effect of women consuming ketogenic or drastically carbohydrate-restricted diets during breastfeeding? Might this inadvertently result in lower ketone levels in the infant due to lower MCT levels in the mother's breast milk?
Well, I haven't studied it and I haven't really looked at the literature on it, but my guess is that no, I don't see an issue for two reasons. You don't have to consume glucose to make glucose. The body can make all the glucose it needs from a variety of sources. So if glucose is the only substrate for medium-chain fatty acid synthesis, then I still think that's eminently possible from amino acids in particular. The other thing is, if you've only ever used glucose to study medium-chain fatty acid synthesis, you might assume that that's the only source. But in fact, I would imagine that the acetyl-CoA that's necessary could come from other sources as well. So I think there's some work to be done to validate the premise that glucose is the only source. But even if it were to be the only source of substrate for medium-chain fatty acids, I think the humans would have no problem surviving that.
It would be interesting to understand the mechanistic difference then between humans and the rodents, in that this is a strong effect in rodents, and this is what generated the question. So if it's the case that you're correct, and I think you probably are, it would be revealing then to understand the mechanistic difference.
Well, the similarity between rodents and humans is they both have a relatively high brain-to-body weight ratio, which is not the case in other big mammals the same size as humans. So they have, to some extent, the same constraint on brain energy metabolism. I'm not sure if it actually applies, but at least there's plenty of opportunity to do research on that.
STEM Talk is an educational service of the Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition, a not-for-profit research lab pioneering groundbreaking technologies aimed at leveraging and extending human cognition, perception, locomotion, and resilience.
So, Stephen, you described how certain brain-selective nutrients such as DHA, iodine, iron, selenium, zinc, and copper would be best supplied by a shore-based diet. So which shores is the first question, and then which types of foods made up this diet during human evolution, and what's the evidence for that?
Well, the evidence is based on the problem that we have today in areas of the world where these nutrients are not consumed sufficiently, particularly with iron and iodine. The people that run into iodine deficiency, or iron deficiency for that matter, are away from the shores. They're inland. Mm-hmm. And they don't have access to fish. Culturally, they may not fish much, even if they're on lakes. But the major issue is that they don't have access to shellfish or aquatic plants or fish. So that's the basic evidence, and the problem was severe enough that 100 years ago we had to develop a way to provide iodine artificially, and it turned out to be in table salt, and that's still an excellent solution. So shore-based foods, it's a very generic kind of term, and it's basically any shore-based foods, because the seashores have more iodine in particular than freshwater. So if you really want the best sources of iodine, you go to the seashores. The challenge is that living on a seashore is much more difficult than living on freshwater, lakes, estuaries, marshes, and so on. And the evidence that we actually occupied seacoasts 2 million years ago is not good. So we would definitely have started on freshwater shores, lakes, rivers, estuaries, marshes. We would have consumed freshwater fish. Catfish in particular are very, very prevalent in fossil sites in East Africa. They're very abundant today. They're very easy to catch. Tilapia is a form of perch that's also very accessible, and they have lots of DHA. They don't have as much DHA as salmon or mackerel, but you don't need to eat salmon or mackerel in order to meet your brain's DHA or iodine requirements for that matter. So the iron, the iodine starts out in the volcanic rocks that come up with the volcanic eruptions and gets washed down towards the sea. So there's more iron iodine in aquatic plants and aquatic mammals and fish than there is in freshwater, but there's still more in freshwater fish than there is in plants. So it's a question of having an ecological niche that you can adapt to, and it's certain that at least 100,000 years ago, we were already using the seacoast to explore. So we had habituated to living in those sorts of environments because Australia was first inhabited over 80,000 years ago. And the minimum distance at that time between Australia as an island and the mainland was 60 miles. 60 miles, you can't even see that far across the water. So there's no way they knew that Australia was out there like a day's fishing trip. This would have been a week or 2 weeks. It would have been some sort of nautical craft that was constructed. They were familiar with the water. They were familiar and totally at ease. And so they were using the seacoast at some point. So that's not at the beginning of our evolution. But the point is, did the iodine consumption come after we had the big brain because we'd now mastered the seacoast, or did it come before? Mm-hmm. And I would argue it came before in the freshwater environment, because Olduvai Gorge, for instance, was colonized, if you will, by hominids, Homo habilis, the toolmaker, over 2 million years ago. And that's when the brain evolution started. That's when the tool making started. And that was a freshwater environment. But it was connected via the Rift Valley to the sea. So it's a question of exploiting and gradually exploring. And that's how it happened.
So, Stephen, at Sherbrooke, your research is focused on the use of brain imaging techniques to study changing brain fuel metabolism and cognitive function during aging. Can you give us an overview of what you're finding?
Well, our first focus was on healthy aging. We needed a reference group. If you want to study Alzheimer's disease, you need to age match. So if your population has got a neurological problem, you've got to be able to look at people that are cognitively healthy at the same age. So our first goal was to set up a study and to find cognitively healthy people. How do you define cognitively healthy at any age? There are norms, but anyway, we went forward with that, and that was the main focus. And we found that even our cognitively healthiest individuals, over 50 people studied now, have lower brain glucose uptake in the frontal cortex, in the front of the brain. So we were pretty sure that the problem with glucose was present before people get Alzheimer's disease. And that was confirmed by studies that had been done elsewhere on people with APOE4, for instance, which is a risk factor, people with the presenilin gene, which which is a very serious risk factor. So it was helping us build momentum around the idea that the glucose problem, the energy problem in the brain, predated the onset of the cognitive problem. Mm-hmm. Because obviously if a neuron is dying because it's had some kind of toxic insult, it's not going to need glucose. So the glucose problem can come after neuronal death as well. And in mm-hmm. fact, that's what led us to the vicious cycle idea, that it starts with a problem, a low-grade asymptomatic problem that gradually gets worse and brings on the neuropathology, brings on the cognitive problems. People become more reclusive. They're less socially interactive. And so the neurons are less used, and it's use it or lose it. And they die, and that it develops a vicious cycle.
So we talked about this a little bit already, but we're now seeing an increasing interest in exogenous ketones for neurological disease. And these ketone esters can elevate BHB levels far beyond those normally attained during a ketogenic diet. So what are your current thoughts on initiation of ketosis through medium-chain triglycerides versus exogenous ketones? So we're talking about salts or esters versus carbohydrate restriction versus fasting. Do you think the mechanisms involved behind each of them are different?
Well, it's a big question, and it's a big field now. I guess starting with the question of, are the mechanisms the same or are the effects the same? A ketogenic diet is going to provide ketones. Fasting is going to provide ketones. There's some common threads for sure. Are they going to provide the same ratio of acetoacetate to beta-hydroxybutyrate? I don't think anyone really knows. In fact, probably some people have shown that you don't have exactly the same. But a ketogenic diet also is going to involve mobilizing fatty acids from endogenous stores. And some of those fatty acids, like the docosahexaenoic acid, DHA, are going to be used within the body, not as fuels, not to make ketones, but in the brain, in the heart, in other organs. So that's a mechanism that you won't get from an MCT, a medium-chain triglyceride. That's a mechanism you won't get from a salt or an ester. Fasting, perhaps. Fasting is a short-term solution. You've got to stop fasting at some point. So what do you eat when you stop fasting? If it's ketogenic, then you'll probably stay in a state of ketosis. If it's not, then you end up in a kind of a yo-yo dieting thing. So for some people, these are fads, you know?
Yeah.
Like every other diet, for many people, is a fad, like starting a new exercise program.
Your tracer work has used 11C acetoacetate in the setting of endogenous ketosis and neurological disease. As beta-hydroxybutyrate and acetoacetate occur in a relatively predictable one-to-one ratio at low levels of ketosis, as seen in the ketogenic diet, it's fair to assume that an acetoacetate label is a good representation of ketone metabolism. Most exogenous ketones give beta-hydroxybutyrate and do not increase acetoacetate to anywhere near the same extent. Do you anticipate there being differences in brain ketone metabolism between endogenous and exogenous ketosis as a result of the differences in the beta-hydroxybutyrate acetoacetate ratio?
I think the simple answer is there probably would be differences. Giving the ketone salt or ester as beta-hydroxybutyrate is still going to involve converting it to acetoacetate at the metabolism stage in the mitochondria. That's what gets burned to CO2. That's what generates ATP. So the beta-hydroxybutyrate is a transport form of ketone. It's more stable. It's a good way to store it, if you will, and move it around the body. When the body endogenously makes ketones, it makes acetoacetate first and then converts it. So there's an equilibrium between the two. And I'm sure we can make that equilibrium go one way or the other with different techniques. Our acetoacetate PET, I think it's important to say, can be used to calculate the total ketone utilization by the brain or by another organ. It's a calculation. That same calculation has to be done if you started with beta-hydroxybutyrate as a tracer, as was done 20 years ago in two papers. So either way, you've got to make some assumptions, you've got to make some calculations, and it depends on what question you're trying to answer as to the validity of starting with one form of ketosis versus another.
People have noted that ketones are 10% more efficient than glucose as a brain fuel. In 2010, Lamana et al. Noted that under conditions of ketosis, glucose consumption is decreased in the cortex and cerebellum by about 10% for each millimolar of plasma ketone bodies. What is your understanding of cerebral fuel selection given ample availability of both glucose and ketones?
Well, my understanding from our work and from the literature is that the ketones are the preferred fuel, and they will be used by the brain in proportion to their availability. So the 10% figure, I think, probably comes from the circumstances of the study that was done, but I'm sure it can be higher than 10%. It can be up to 80 or 90% actually during starvation. They're preferentially used, but even mole for mole, you actually generate more ATP and use less oxygen if you run the heart or the brain on ketones rather than glucose.
So, Stephen, are there any areas of the brain that are particularly high users of ketone bodies? And if so, could this have any link to some of the functional or behavioral changes, such as mood, that are seen in some cases of animals or people adhering to a ketogenic diet?
The gray matter areas of the brain use more ketones as they use more glucose. The white matter areas use less. The ratio is about, from our PET data, is about 2 to 1. So the outer cortex of the brain uses about twice as much as the deep subcortical areas and the white matter. Mm. And that's basically what you see with glucose. So the ratio of consumption of glucose and ketones is pretty much the same. Where it varies for one, it varies for the other. As far as whether that accounts for behavioral improvements, if you will, that you might see under certain conditions of ketosis, I don't think anyone can say. We haven't explored it.
Yeah. Really interesting. So you've also looked at how and why omega-3 fatty acid homeostasis changes during aging. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, this was one of our interests as I got started at the Research Center on Aging, and we were setting up the ketone PET, and there was still a lot of time to do methods development, and I still had a strong interest in omega-3 fatty acids and what kind of nutrition we should be providing to older people. The question again was, how are nutrients metabolized in older people? Can they make ketones normally? The answer is yes. Can they use DHA normally? And the answer is a qualified yes. It's different. It takes longer to metabolize a dose of DHA in an older person than it does in a younger person. That's kind of empirical, but it's what we've seen with supplements. And so we use stable isotopes, DHA-labeled stable isotopes, and followed the isotope over a month and found that it's quite a different pattern in older people, in healthy older people, cognitively normal, than it is in young people. Mm. We haven't been able to push that any further because the stable isotope is limited to blood samples and breath samples, and you can't get inside the body any further. So maybe we can do some DHA PET one of these days and take it a little further.
Yeah, that'd be really interesting. So what, in your opinion, are the primary challenges that our brains face as we age?
I guess the simplest terms, use it or lose it. And that's the issue, keeping mentally active without too much stress, a balance between stimulation and lethargy. It's like muscle. It's really very much the same idea. There's going to be toxins in our environment, and there's going to be drugs that we're going to be taking that might not be beneficial for the brain, but might be necessary for pain management or something else. But the things that we can do for those that can stay active is to stay active cognitively and to stay active physically, because the two go hand in hand. Excess insulin is a major driver of cognitive problems in older people. It's, of course, related to a sedentary lifestyle. Mm-hmm. So the two go hand in hand. It's very hard to separate. In fact, I don't think we should separate muscle health from metabolic health from brain health.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So you're now particularly focused on Alzheimer's disease and ketones, which are the brain's backup fuel. Can you give us an overview of your research that is looking at how someone with Alzheimer's disease can use ketones to their advantage?
Well, what we've learned is that brain cells that are struggling to use glucose can still use ketones normally. So the person with Alzheimer's disease can either take a supplement or try and do some more physical activity to increase the level of ketosis, because there's not going to be any miracles in Alzheimer's disease. That's for sure. But one can take incremental steps in the right direction, especially before the disease gets too advanced. And so one could start supplementing with ketone salts or ketone esters. They're available. They're expensive. They're not really well documented yet. Even with medium chain triglycerides, which we're working on in controlled clinical studies, we can't say that the documentation is very strong, and the published work so far is very modest. And I think there's two reasons. Either they're not going to work, and the reason that they haven't worked well is because they don't work well, or it's because we haven't achieved the dose that's necessary. When you look at the deficit of glucose in the Alzheimer brain, it's around 20%. That represents at least 20 grams a day of fuel that's not coming in. 20 grams, nearly an ounce, if you will. So basically, you need to find the equivalent of that form of fuel in another source. Mm-hmm. 20 grams of ketones would have replaced 20 grams of glucose. But to make 20 grams of ketones, you need to provide a lot more, because the brain's only taking 1/5 of the body's blood flow and the body's energy metabolism. So you can quickly calculate that we should be well over 50 grams a day of your ketogenic product, mm-hmm, in order to meet the requirements of the deteriorating brain glucose uptake. No study has done that yet. Mm. So the fact that studies haven't been very successful with a keto strategy is due to the fact that we haven't been able to get to a dose that's tolerable and effective. But that's achievable. I think we have those types of supplements now. We understand the basis with the ketone PET for what the therapeutic objective should be. We'll see within the next couple of years whether, in fact, it's attainable.
So, Stephen, we know that APOE4 carriers have an increased risk of development of late-onset familial Alzheimer's disease. Is there a link that we know of between APOE4 genotype and a change in brain metabolism?
There's some observations. I don't think anyone understands why they occur the way they do, but people with that are APOE4 carriers have a problem getting glucose into the brain in their 30s. That's been reported once, and that was in 2004, so that's 14 years ago. It hasn't been confirmed to my knowledge. So was that a lucky observation, a chance observation, or is that a solid observation? It needs to be confirmed. That's clear. But APOE4 is not specific to brain energy metabolism. It's a very pluripotent sort of substance. It does a lot of things with cholesterol. It affects ketone metabolism. And you've got it or you don't. At the moment, that's not predictive of whether you're going to get Alzheimer's disease. It's a risk factor, but it's not predictive. We don't have a treatment for Alzheimer's. So even if you've done the analysis and know that you're a carrier of one or two alleles of APOE4, it's not going to provide a solution for you. It's going to create a dilemma.
Right.
And there's no evidence that people that are APOE4 carriers are not going to be treatable at all when it comes to Alzheimer's disease. So I would be very cautious as an individual about learning my APOE4 status and thinking that I can build a strategy around that, because right now we don't have one.
Does substrate utilization differ between healthy subjects and those with neurological conditions, such as mild cognitive impairment or Alzheimer's disease?
Definitely brain glucose metabolism is going down once mild cognitive impairment has started, and it gets worse in Alzheimer's disease. It's already a little bit lower in cognitively healthy older people. In all three conditions, brain ketone metabolism, basal or stimulated by a medium chain triglyceride, does not change in the few experiments that have been done. There's no sign that there's any problem getting ketones into the brain. So there's definitely a difference between the two.
Great answer.
So, Stephen, what other metabolic interventions do you think have promise for neurodegenerative disease?
I think interventions that help eliminate insulin resistance are going to be really important for successful interventions in Alzheimer's disease. There's already evidence that intranasal insulin, for instance, can be beneficial. Exercise is beneficial for a variety of reasons, but one of the things I think it does is to reduce insulin resistance. Insulin is kind of like the policeman in the intersection directing traffic, but he never gets out of the way, or she, and never lets the ketones get out. So once insulin resistance is present, it's not only helping block glucose utilization, but it's also blocking ketone production, which is kind of putting the brain in double jeopardy.
And exercise helps get more ketones into the brain, but how much exercise is needed to do that effectively, do you think?
Any amount is better than none.
Yeah.
We've done this with 3 exercise sessions per week over a 3-month period in Alzheimer's patients, and we saw quite a marked effect on brain ketone uptake and a mild effect on cognition. The study was not scaled, didn't have enough people to really nail the cognitive aspects, but the increased ketone uptake was very, very clear. So one could extrapolate and say, well, if you did half as much exercise, you'd get half as much improvement in brain ketone uptake. That's still a significant improvement. But the question is not, to me, the intensity of the exercise, but rather the duration. Is this going to be a lifestyle change, or is this something that the person's going to stop after nobody's supervising them anymore and they're not coming to the research center?
Right. And also for older people who might not be able to exercise effectively, you recommend a ketone drink made from medium chain triglycerides that people can make in their kitchen. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, so some people have disabilities and there's some forms of exercise they could still do. But the way to, I think, optimize the effect of exercise is to provide ketones. The cheapest way to do that right now is with a medium chain triglyceride supplement. And you can buy the medium chain triglyceride and mix it at home into the form that you like the most. Put it in orange juice. You can put it in a milk drink, make a milkshake. You can make a smoothie with it. You can put it in cereal. You can put it in soup. You can put it in salad. So you can use it the way you want to. And that's good for some people. And it also, some people like to have a recipe. So you can also buy medium chain triglyceride drinks that are pre-made or powdered forms. The powdered forms are maybe more accessible, but they also have a much lower concentration of MCT.
The medium chain triglyceride oil is just wonderful on sushi. So if you have sushi that's maybe not the fattiest sushi and you want fatty sushi,
yeah,
you just put a little bit of MCT oil on the sushi, like on your tuna sushi or whatever you're having, and it's rich and has this unctuous mouth feel, much more like Toro or expensive tuna would taste.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Even as a vegetarian, I could do that.
Well, there's a nice synergy between the ketones and the exercise, and the exercise helps amplify the effect of taking a certain amount of MCT. So you don't have to give yourself a stomach ache with the MCT in order to get the benefits. If you do some exercise, you can moderate the dose of MCT and still get quite a good rise in brain ketones.
As noted earlier, with the advent of exogenous ketones, particularly the ketone esters, folks will have perhaps more effective options to elevate their level of circulating ketones. As you mentioned, they're currently quite expensive, the esters, but it's exciting times. It looks like in the near future, people will be able to do the studies that he was talking about, where, you know, two drinks of a ketone ester is 50 grams.
Yeah. Well, the challenge in any of these studies with the supplements is that the ketone level goes up and it goes down fairly quickly. So repeating the dose in a format that's going to be acceptable is the challenge. Acceptability, tolerability is going to be probably the bottleneck.
With the ester, it's up for about 4 to 6 hours.
Well, that's excellent because then with some exercise, it might stay up longer. A dose at bedtime would permit you to have a higher level at night when you're not eating. Most of us, anyway.
Especially when coupled with diet. You know, in the population that you're looking at, I can imagine people not necessarily drinking the entire bottle, but at once.
Certainly not at once.
But having it through the day in top of the diet to get the elevated beta-hydroxybutyrate levels you were talking about.
And one of the main issues with aging is insulin resistance, type 2 diabetes. So if you combine it with exercise, you get your insulin levels down and you provide more ketones as well. So I think people need to think in more than one approach. There's no magic bullets. MCT can do something. Maybe a ketone salt can do it better, but they can only do so much. You need to approach this with two or three synergistic approaches at the same time.
So Stephen, does chronically high systemic inflammation, so as measured by high sensitivity CRP, for example, contribute to neuroinflammation and cognitive decline? And if so, would targeting systemic inflammation with nutritional ketosis be an acceptable strategy to enhance and also preserve cognitive function and brain longevity?
I think it's a very exciting opportunity. I don't think there's any results that really convincingly address that question yet, but I think there's some good indicators that ketones can help control pro-inflammatory processes systemically. We have some PET tracers that can look at neuroinflammation. So these studies are waiting to be done. It's going to take some investment of private and public funds to do it, but the people are skilled to do it. The tools are there, and there's certainly a need to establish it because inflammation is a process that destroys tissue, of course. It also consumes energy. So the glucose that's getting into the brain of a person with Alzheimer's disease, some of it's going to fuel these overexcited microglia and inflammatory processes. So you're actually losing some of that brain fuel to protect the brain against a process that's getting out of control.
Mm-hmm. So we know ketones increase brain blood flow and metabolism. Do you think that some of the beneficial effects might be working through the newly discovered brain lymphatic system or glymphatic system?
I can well imagine that. I haven't thought about it before. I guess, again, if we have the tools, it's not hard to establish whether that's the case.
That would be fascinating.
I'm already spinning on some ideas there, so we can chat later.
Sure.
Yeah. So right now in the U.S., there are about 5 million people with Alzheimer's disease. In 30 years, that number is expected to swell to 16 million. Do you think this dramatic increase in the prevalence of Alzheimer's that's being predicted is related to the epidemic that we have of type 2 diabetes and other chronic diseases related to the Western diet?
I'm sure there's a strong association. I think there's some very good epidemiology that shows that that association is very strong, is very real. It's driving the process. And it's not just a disease of older people. Type 2 diabetes is not a disease of older people. It's present, obviously, in young adults. It's present in adolescents and horribly in children as well. So if those people don't change their lifestyle, then they've got it for their lifetimes. And longevity is going to be affected. Life expectancy is going to go down in Western countries. It's already the case in some countries. And it'll be the case in the USA for sure if the trend towards the diabetes epidemic doesn't reverse. Mm.
Coupled with the opioids addiction problem, it could be a dramatic decline when you combine the diabetes problem with that addiction.
Absolutely.
One sees a spat of recent papers, especially those from Verdon's lab and also from UC Davis, that show pretty dramatic improvements in both health span and lifespan in rodents fed a ketogenic diet. Of course, humans are not rats. Well, at least most of us are not rats. Given all this, what are your thoughts on prolonged ketosis as a promoter of human health span and perhaps even longevity?
I think there's lots of potential for research in this area. It's important to consider not just the quantity of life, but the quality of life. And most older people would agree that it's not how long they're going to live that matters to them. It's how good those years are going to be. The rodent models are interesting. In Alzheimer's disease, almost none of them that have shown therapeutic effects have actually been translatable to humans. So ultimately, that's the test. I would look for quality of years over quantity of years in terms of longevity.
Yes, in this last year, there have been a cluster of closely related papers showing significant increases in health span and also increases in lifespan, but it's the health span part that's so fascinating.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So, Stephen, we've been talking about research and science. Talk to us a little bit about your interests outside of your work.
Well, it's the winter right now, at least where I live. The snow has been great. I'm a cross-country skier, have been for quite a long time, and I'm probably in better shape in the winter than I am in the summer, because if the snow's any good, I'll do anything to get out there for 30 minutes or something. I have fields out behind my place, and we have to make the trails ourselves, me and my neighbor, 71 years old, and the two of us are out there pounding the boards whenever we can. I like that. I play badminton in the winter, and I golf a little bit in the summer. At least I pretend to golf. And I like things around the yard as well, landscaping. I've got a rambling sort of property, and we've done a little bit of landscaping and work like that. I like working with my hands.
Fantastic. Well, it's been awesome having you on the podcast. Thank you for coming.
Yeah, it was
Thanks.
Great. Thank you, Stephen.
I appreciate it. It's a tremendously beneficial initiative, I think, these talks for the public. So I appreciate the opportunity. Thanks.
Glad you're here.
STEM Talk.
Well, I have to say, it's always fun talking to Stephen. You have to wonder what it will take for the therapeutic use of ketones to become more commonplace in the medical community.
Yes, it does indeed seem, as Stephen pointed out, that the ketogenic diet is still, for the most part, treated like an orphan in the medical and research communities. Yet, as the work of Stephen and others demonstrate, ketone bodies, both endogenous and exogenous, offer great promise in helping us deal with a wide range of neurodegenerative disorders.
If you enjoyed this interview as much as we did, I invite you to visit the STEM Talk webpage, where you can find the show notes for this and other episodes, stemtalk.us. This is Don Kernaghi signing off for now.
And this is Ken Ford saying goodbye until we meet again on STEM Talk.
Thank you for listening to STEM Talk. We want this podcast to be discovered by others. So please take a minute to go to iTunes to rate the podcast and perhaps even write a review. More information about this and other episodes can be found at our website, stemtalk.us. There, you can also find more information about the guests we interview.